For this reading, Ecclesiasticus is how it is usually referred to. Obviously, a play on the word Ecclesiastes. It's more commonly known as Sirach, or the wisdom of Jesus, or Jesus, son of Sirach, or Joshua, son of Sirach, depending how you want to read that word. Or the Jews sometimes just call it Sirach, or Ben Sirach, son of Sirach. Does the writer, if you had a chance to read it, does he claim, especially that first really long verse, does he claim to be an inspired writer? No, in fact, he's saying he wrote down what? What's he really saying he wrote down? Okay, he's translating what his father, his grandfather, had accumulated a knowledge, and he said he got his knowledge from, did he get it from God? He was inspired. Not directly. He says he got it from God in what sense? Yeah, a lifetime of study of the Scripture. He'd spent his life studying Scripture, and he tried to put it into words that he thought would be helpful. And his grandson tries to translate it. Why does he need to translate it? What language is he translating it into? He doesn't say. Obviously, you read in the original, you would know which. He's translating it out of the Hebrew and into Greek. And we'll talk about why here this in just a few moments. So he's translating into Greek, and once you get past the introduction verse, what does it really remind you of? Which kinds of books in the Bible? Yeah, the wisdom, Proverbs, maybe Ecclesiastes. Actually, to me, it reminds me more of Proverbs than it does Ecclesiastes, especially the first chapter. Reminds you of the first several chapters of Proverbs. It's all about wisdom. If you go further into the book of Ecclesiasticus, Ben Sirach, it's more, to me, it reminds me more of Ben Franklin's Poor Richard Almanac. It gets down into the just, you know, common sense sort of things, you know, how you should live your life, things Grandpa told you. But he starts it off, he tries really good to try to make it sound like wisdom literature from the Bible. How does it compare with the wisdom literature of the Bible? The things like Proverbs. I assume you guys have studied Proverbs at least. Read it a few times.
Fairly similar.
A lot of borrowed language, a lot of borrowed imagery. Doesn't really go anywhere new. But again, he's not claiming to do anything new. What would it remind you of, not in the Bible, but perhaps at your bookstore? Okay, something like The Message or some paraphrase. It is pretty much a paraphrase of Proverbs. Might remind you of just some good, you know, self-help kind of books. Here's some thoughts for you to think about, some devotional material you might pick up. And that's really how the Jews viewed it and still view it. It's interesting, the Catholics have picked it up and said, ooh, here's something, you know, a hidden book from the Bible. No, it's not a hidden book of the Bible. The Jews never thought of it as a hidden book of the Bible. It's not part of their Bible. It shouldn't be part of ours. It's just some good literature. It, you know, can go on your shelf next to other devotional material. It's, you know, it's decent reading. Has a few good thoughts. As I said, he based it on his own study of Scripture, and even in that first verse, he sort of gives some caveats. You know, if I failed, it may be my translation. I guess he's also saying if it fails, it may just be that Grandpa didn't get it right. This evening, in our study, we're going to cover a lot of history again. It's going to be like a couple of classes ago. Going to move quickly through a lot of material. And like I have been doing, I'm going to go ahead and put the whole slide up there so you can look at it. I may or may not comment on everything that I have up on the slide. Sometimes I may be going a little bit fast. Someone has asked if I can provide copies. I can do that at some point. I'll either make the slides available or email them out to you. People can let me know how they would like it. I keep changing, so I'm not going to do it until I'm done. Then I can send out the whole thing and you can go back through it. We left off in our study of the Greeks a few weeks ago. From Alexander the Great, we covered the first 50 years, 322 down to about 275, with the war between all his different generals and how they were basically killing one another over who got to be the regent of the empire. And then eventually they just wanted to be kings themselves and they got rid of the heir, Alexander's son. We're going to move to just what was happening around Israel. And for the first part, from 322 to 198, that was when Egypt was in control. Egypt was led by the Ptolemies. Ptolemy was the first general, and all the children named themselves after their ancestor, the general who was granted Egypt. The Ptolemies, the first couple of them, did a lot of really good building and rebuilding. A lot of good Greek architecture that you find in Egypt today, or the ruins of it, were because of the early Ptolemies. They, especially the second of the Ptolemies, was the one who promulgated the Septuagint, the LXX version. That is a, what is the Septuagint? Greek translation of the Old Testament. Because so many Jews lived outside of Israel, that a lot of them had pretty much forgotten Hebrew. They had spent all those years in exile, those who spoke now more Aramaic from being in Babylon, those who spoke more Greek or Egyptian, the Coptic languages. And the Ptolemy king said he thought it would be good for himself. He was a learned man. He wanted to learn what the Jews... Remember, Alexander had granted the Jews one quarter of Alexandria. He wanted to know what they believed. And he thought it'd be good, and therefore he paid for scholars to sit and to translate the Bible into Greek. And it's interesting that most of the New Testament writers, when they quote from the Septuagint. When they're quoting and they're writing in Greek, they quote the Septuagint, it seems. During this period, Hellenization, didn't define the word up there. What is Hellenization? High school. Okay, yeah, we mean by that, yeah, the adoption of Greek philosophy, the adoption of Greek culture, Greek way of life, way of thinking. Like today we might say westernize, right? One of the goals America usually has is to westernize other countries. We want to make them like us. Well, the Greeks had the same idea. Let's make them like us. We'll have less problems if people become like us. And so they were trying to Hellenize. And during the Ptolemy period, they did it gradually. They weren't trying to force anyone to become Greek. But, you know, when everything is spoken in Greek, and now you can have your own scriptures in Greek, it becomes easier and easier for people to start adopting the Greek way of life. The Ptolemies wanted people to become Greek and to accept their rule and to pay their taxes, right? That's really why they wanted to hold on to Syria, or at least that portion of Syria, that Judea and Lebanon, the area just north of it. They hoped that would be a way of getting some revenue. It began sort of a polarizing thing, though, this idea of becoming more Greek. And I said, you know, up there that it's between the Oneids, meaning the family of Onias. Onias was the family of high priest at the time. And they wanted people to speak what? You don't even have to know history to know that. They thought if you're a Jew, you should speak Hebrew. Good Jews speak Hebrew. And the Tobiads, you might remember Tobiah from the study of Nehemiah. And the Tobiads were basically a conglomeration of wealthy merchants, kind of like Tobiah, who wanted people to adopt the Greek way of life and let's all make a lot of money and let's, you know, be happy. And so the idea of being a Hellenist or a Hebrew begins to sort of separate Jews. Are you a Hellenistic Jew or are you a Hebrew Jew? You can tell by the way people speak, right? What language do they speak in? You begin to tell by the way people dress. Are they dressing like Greeks or are they dressing like Hebrews? And it doesn't end there. What happened in Acts chapter 6? Yeah, the Grecian widows, the Hellenistic widows, thought they were being neglected within the ministration of food. You know, those Hebrew guys, they're not giving us our fair share. Right? That becomes an issue within the early church. And we'll talk about why. It wasn't just 200 BC. 200 years later, it's still going strong. And it gets worse, actually, over the next 50 years, we'll see. During this period, there are at least five different, what were called the Syrian Wars. That's between Egypt and the Seleucids. Just to remind you, there's the Ptolemy Kingdom, basically Egypt, plus the areas of North Africa. The Seleucids, which were at that point, we would say today, basically Afghanistan, Iran, Iraq, Syria, and portions of Turkey, right? The Seleucids were really the bigger kingdom, but Ptolemies, at least the first 50 years, were the stronger kingdom. At least they thought they were. And so they have these wars, one going up, one coming down. All of them were prophesied in the book of Daniel. We talked about it in our Daniel class. I had some handouts on it. I won't go over all those different wars. But I'm going to jump us down to around the time of 200 BC, where Antiochus, not the one we've been talking about that we'll get to in a few minutes, but his father, Antiochus III. I was going to skip Antiochus III and his first son who became king, but then I tried to think of how can I give you the background for Antiochus Epiphanes without explaining his father. His father, Antiochus III, started his reign by attacking Egypt. His father had won some parts of Syria, and then the Egyptians had taken it back. Antiochus begins basically as a warrior kind of king, takes back the land that had been taken, the northern parts, down to what in New Testament times would be Caesarea, that didn't exist at the time. But once he got down that far, just north of Judea, north of Galilee, right? Caesarea, just right off of Galilee, he accepted a truce from the Egyptians. He said, sure, we'll make peace. He went back and resupplied, and he was back 4 months later and attacking again. The Egyptians took him at his word. And weren't ready to be attacked again. And so 4 months later, he conquers all the way down to Gaza. And then he thinks, well, this is going easy. I'll just go ahead and take Egypt while I'm here. And he invades, and he loses. He loses big to Ptolemy IV. And Ptolemy pushes him back northward, and Ptolemy thinks, you know, I need some plunder in order to pay this army that I've raised. And so he sees the temple in Jerusalem, and it gets plundered. All right, raid the temple, find the treasury, let's pay our troops from the temple treasury. And you'll see over the next few years it happens all the time. Because the Jews are contributing, right? They each give at least a shekel a year. They're supposed to tithe as well. And the kings find it a very convenient place. It's almost like having an ATM machine on the way. You know, you need to stop, grab some money, right? Here's the temple. Antiochus was kind of upset that he had just lost all the territory he had regained, that his father had lost. And so he decides to build an army, a real army. He thinks his problem was that his army wasn't well enough trained. And so he begins hiring mercenaries from places like Greece to train his army. He takes his army out and practices with them against the borderlands like India, Pakistan. Lets them get some experience fighting. So that 14 years later, he was a patient man. 14 years later, when Ptolemy IV died and his heir was just a little child, he thought, now's the time. And he takes that new army he has and he attacks, reconquering Phoenicia, Lebanon, Arabia, Judea, all in the year 198. And he thinks, wow, that was so easy. You know, this new army I've got is such a great thing that I'm going to go further west. And we're going to take Egypt. And some of the Jews volunteered. Hey, yeah, we'll join you. We want to get our chance to get back at the Egyptians for plundering our temple. Especially the brother of the high priest, a man named Jason. The high priest was Onias. His brother was Jason. And Jason said he would lead a large part of the Jewish people in support of Antiochus III free of charge. All you have to do is make me high priest. And hey, here's some cash to go with it. And Antiochus, you know, he was a corrupt man. I mean, what did he care who the Jewish high priest was? Who was supposed to be Jewish high priest? Sons of Aaron. Yeah, sons of Levi. Further, sons of Aaron. Further, break it down in David's day, sons of Zadok. Right? In David's day, God said the sons of Zadok will be high priest, and all the other priests were given other assignments. And Onias was of the house of Zadok, but so was Jason. And so the king simply said, okay, Onias, you're no longer high priest. Jason's high priest. And about that time, Ptolemy sends some emissaries up and says, we want peace. We don't want you to invade us with this army, with all these Jews as well. What are your terms? And the terms were kind of simple. You've got to marry my daughter. The Ptolemy has to marry my daughter, Cleopatra. And that's not the Cleopatra in the movies. We'll get to her eventually. She's the seventh. This is Cleopatra the first. You marry Cleopatra, and everything will be fine. And Ptolemy says, oh, okay, I'll marry her. So she becomes queen of Egypt, and of course what he's thinking is, eventually Ptolemy's going to die, and then my grandson is going to be king of Egypt, and hey, it's all in the family, right? Then we can just join the empires together. It didn't work that way. But that's his idea. And it might not have worked that way because this was 198 BC, and the marriage didn't take place for another 5 years because even 5 years later, the bride was only 10 years old. A little bit young. And apparently she didn't like her father because as soon as she had the chance to give him the empire, the kingdom, she said no. That's what you get for selling off your daughter at five. But that was his idea at the time. Guess it seemed like a good idea. And of course, the Ptolemy king wasn't very much older. He was only 16 at the wedding. So since he already had Judea and he thought he had Egypt, at least by marriage, Antiochus had the great idea, like the great Persian kings before him, like Darius, to invade Greece. All right, how'd that work for Darius? Yeah, not so good. Didn't work for Xerxes either. They both tried it. Both of them lost. But he thought, you know, he's got a great army. I mean, we just conquered Egypt, basically, you know, without any struggle at all. And we have a secret weapon by the name of Hannibal. Anyone remember Hannibal? Not from the movies. Think elephants, not, you know. great general of Carthage, right? The Phoenician general from the North African city of Carthage. You know, you don't read about him much in most history books after he gets defeated several times, both in Italy and then eventually back home in Carthage. Hannibal didn't just disappear. He actually ran to the Seleucid kingdom to keep from getting killed. And so now Antiochus thinks, not only do I have this great army, now I've got a great general to go with it. Hannibal's going to lead my army. And everything goes good at the beginning. They took several parts of Greece. They took the islands like Rhodes. The only problem was that Rhodes had an ally. They had made an alliance with Rome. And Rhodes went, some escaped from the capture, and they went to Rome, and they berated the Roman Senate. And basically said the reproach, the shame was on them because they failed their alliance. I mean, they really didn't have time. It was a sneak attack. But they really let the Roman Senate have it for failing. And the Senate immediately started thinking, well, what do we do? We've got some great generals. The man on the left is Scipio Africanus, the man who defeated Hannibal, the man who crushed Carthage, who took his army and burned down the city of Carthage. And a lot of people said, well, let's send Scipio Africanus after Hannibal again. And his brother said, no, send me. I want to show you I'm just as good a general as my brother is. I want to go. And Scipio Africanus said, I'm tired of war. You know, let him go. You know, let him try it out. And so the man on the right, Scipio Africanus, Asiaticus, as he came to be known, was granted an army and told that it was up to him to bring honor back to Rome after they had been shamed. And to the surprise of everyone, because Scipios were both farmers, pig farmers, they both turned out to be very, very, very great generals, battlefield commanders. I don't know if being a pig farmer helps with that or not, but he managed to defeat Hannibal on the land. He defeated him at sea. He defeated him from island to island. He kept pushing him back. When Hannibal fled across the Aegean to get back into what we would call Turkey or Asia Minor, he went right after him and kept pushing him back and back until he had basically captured all the officers and captured several members of the royal family. And the Seleucids came, basically Antiochus had to come crawling and ask for terms of peace. And not to be outdone by his brother, he came up with some great terms of peace. He said, first, we need 15,000 talents of silver. I looked it up, that'd be roughly 450 tons. That's just to pay the army. For wasting our time. Second, you need to turn over all your war elephants. We don't like elephants anymore in Rome. We've had enough of them with Hannibal twice now. It's kind of like the START treaty. You know, no ballistic missiles in this case. No war elephants. You know, you turn them all over. I guess they didn't realize they could just go back out in the jungle and get some more. But they're going to pay after the 15,000. They're going to pay 6,000 talents per year tribute. You're no longer going to be a free nation kingdom. You're going to be a tributary kingdom. You're going to pay every year. And if you don't pay, for every year you don't pay, we're going to take some of your territory. That will be your payment. So you pay us cash or you pay us in land. They say, you know, the Greeks conquered the world by force, the Romans were conquering the world by tax and debt. You're in debt, just keep paying us and we'll just keep taking your territory away from you. So they didn't even take back all the territory, they were just going to wait and collect on it. And you have to turn over your heir as a hostage. Always a good thing from, you know, kings, you know, your oldest son becomes our hostage. If you do anything wrong, we'll kill your son. That assumed people love their sons. And when he returns to Rome, they grant Scipio a public triumph where he gets to march down the street. They named him Scipio Asiaticus, conqueror of Asia. And so both brothers got a, got named after a continent. Now Antiochus had a different problem. He had to start thinking of ways to come up with a lot of money really fast because he had a debt to pay every year. He started plundering his own cities. You know, there's no more foreign cities to invade. He started invading his own cities. He finally got to a place in Elymais where he entered their temple and the population rose up and pulled him limb from limb, killed him and those of his guards who were with him. And that's how Antiochus III died. Now, really, I told the story mostly for the fact of the debt, because the debt becomes really important. Because the debt's not done when Antiochus dies. It's a kingdom's debt. All right, the kingdom's going to have to pay every year. And so the first thing the next king always thinks of is, how am I going to pay Rome? And so Seleucus IV becomes king in 187. And he starts immediately. There's a coin with his head and his picture on it there. Trying to think how to pay off these huge debts that he had. And he did it the old-fashioned way. He raised taxes. If everybody pays more taxes, we'll be able to pay these debts. He actually did a bad job. He actually had to give Rome several islands and things because he couldn't pay the debts fast enough. But how it affected Judea, the Jews, they split into two different groups. There were those who said, hey, let's pay the taxes, led by Jason. Remember Jason? He's the one who got to be high priest by paying a bribe. He said, let's all just be good subjects and pay our taxes, and maybe I'll get to stay high priest. And those who felt that was sacrilege, the Onaiads. And since the people found out that Antiochus was dead, Onias came back and he was high priest again. And that's why Jason was leading the party. Let's pay taxes. Let's be good to the king. He was, of course, asking the king to put him back into being high priest. And Seleucus solved the problem by going to the ATM again. Let's just invade and let's just rob the bank. Rather than fight between the two high priestly families, let's just steal what's in the treasury. And so that's what he did. There wasn't a whole lot there, but he took what they had and used it to pay. I think he got almost a year's worth of taxes for Rome that way. But the general who went to get the money for the taxes decided, I want to keep the money. And so he killed Seleucus when he got home and ran off with the money. So Rome wasn't paid and they got some more territory. And we move to yet another man, the one we've been talking about. He even looks kind of evil. Antiochus IV. The Bible, Daniel calls him the vile person. Even several hundred years before he lived. Now, Seleucus IV died. The throne should have gone to his son, who was in Rome. Well, Antiochus was at home. And so he said, he's king. Rome sent back the son, and when the son got back, he murdered the son, as well as the general who came to put the son on the throne. And then Antiochus had to pay a bribe to the Romans, not to get mad because he had killed one of their men and killed the rightful king. And then he killed the rest of his nephews just to make sure that none of them would try to become king. Get you the idea of why he was called the vile person. After getting to the throne, Jason comes back again. Jason approaches Antiochus and says, hey, if you make me high priest, I've got some money for you. And there was such a huge debt. Remember, he's still paying the Roman debt. He thought, okay, you got a huge sum of money, I'll take it. He kicked Onias once again off the throne and put Jason back on the throne, or the high priestly throne, if I can call it the throne. And just a few things there about Antiochus personally. He called himself God Manifest, Epiphanes. He was the manifestation of God. He thought he was Zeus, come in the flesh. You know, like the stories. And yet he was known to get drunk. He was known to behave like a lecher. He was known to sit on balconies and throw stones at people who, as they passed by. And his people called him Epimenes, not to his face, which means the mad one. You know, he was a little bit, you know, mixed up in the head, but... But while he was busy trying to secure the throne, Egypt thought, hey, this would be a great time to get some of that territory like Judea back, because, you know, that's where all that money is in the temple, they always kept thinking. But rather to their surprise, Antiochus, when he heard it, that the Egyptians were invading, he grabbed a small army, a very small army, just a few thousand men, rushed hundreds of miles from Babylon all the way down to Judea, took the Egyptians by complete surprise because they thought he was still in Babylon, and he routed a huge Egyptian army and chased them all the way back down into Egypt, doing something none of his ancestors had ever been able to do, even with a big army. On his way down there, though, when he got as far as Judea before he invaded Egypt, he needed to pay his soldiers to keep fighting for him. And another man came up to him. His name was Menelaus. And Menelaus was a, as you can tell by the name, he was a Hellenistic Jew. And he was a Benjaminite from the tribe of Benjamin. And he was a wealthy merchant. And he said, I'd like to be high priest. I know Jason paid you so much money, I'll pay you double if you make me high priest. And Antiochus, being a man of no principle, kicked Jason off the throne and said, okay, Menelaus, you're high priest. He paid his troops and he continued on his way. We'll get back to this idea of buying and selling the high priesthood. It continues for quite a while. He gets down into Egypt, he starts plundering Egypt, and Rome sends a letter because there's actually two kings and a queen in Egypt, and one of the kings and one of the queens sent a letter to Rome saying, will you please help us? We're your servants. And that's all Rome needed to hear. And they send a letter back to Antiochus saying, you better leave. And if you don't leave, we're going to consider you to be an enemy of the state, an enemy of Rome, which means the war's back on. And unless you're wanting to fight a war with Rome, you better leave. And remember, Antiochus is only in Egypt with a few thousand men. He doesn't know if the Romans have an army nearby. And he decides that, well, I've got some money, I'll leave. Well, while he was in Egypt, the Jews heard a rumor. And the rumor was that Antiochus had died. They hear this rumor a lot. And as soon as they heard Antiochus was dead, Jason grabs 1,000 men and he kicks Menelaus off the high priesthood, takes over the temple, says, okay, I'm high priest again. Of course, Antiochus wasn't dead. And so when Antiochus was coming back through Jerusalem, Menelaus meets him and says, hey, didn't I pay for the high priesthood? Jason's back. And the king decides to get rid of Jason again. And while he's there, he raids the temple treasury yet again. There wasn't much there. It's had been every few years they seem to manage to raid the temple treasury. But he takes what he finds and puts Menelaus back on as high priest. In the meantime, since Egypt asked to be a friend of Rome, that was a term of art, a friend of Rome, the Roman Senate decided they needed an ambassador. And they picked Popilius Lainus, his first name Gaius, Gaius Popilius Lainus, to be the ambassador. He was a well-respected man. He was a consul we'll talk about Rome in a later lesson, I think. But a consul, anyone know what a consul was? Those in the young people's class might remember. Well, we'd probably call all the senators lawyers. Consuls were the two who led the Senate, like the Senate president. And in a sense, they were like president because there was no executive branch in Rome at this point. It was a republic. The Senate led the nation. And consuls were chosen to lead the Senate. And there were two of them, a senior consul and a junior consul. And when you got to a certain point in your career, if everybody liked you and you had done well, usually you would get appointed to be a junior consul, and if you served well, you'd move up the next year to be senior consul. And that's how Roman years are generally classified in Roman history. The year, and it would name the two consuls, who was first consul, senior consul, and who was the second consul. And that would tell you what year it was. And so Roman scholars can go, I know that year because who the two consuls were. Well, once you've gone from junior consul to senior consul, then you become, it's a term you find in the New Testament, proconsul. Once you've done both, you're now proconsul, sort of like consul emeritus. Right? You've been there, you've done that. And Rome thought those were the people you want to send other places. They've shown leadership, they've done all the smaller things. And a proconsul in Rome had the full authority of the Senate of Rome. They could make any decision they wanted and send it back to the Senate, and the Senate would automatically approve it. They wouldn't even fight it. A proconsul had made the decision, Rome was going to do it. So they send the former consul, proconsul, Popilius Lainus, to Egypt. He actually first goes by Cyprus, and when he gets to Cyprus, Antiochus has already blockaded Cyprus. So he heads on down to Egypt, and he arrives, his ships just off the North African coast, and he can see the huge army. That's how huge an army Antiochus has. He's already invaded Egypt. He's about 10 to 15 miles outside the city of Alexandria. And Popilius says to his men to set him ashore by himself. And he walks to the center of the road and waits for the army. And the army comes back to Antiochus and says, there's a Roman in the street. And he says he's an ambassador. And he wants to meet the king. And Antiochus approaches with an armed guard. And Popilius says, no. One-to-one. And Antiochus walks over and sticks his hand out as a friend to grasp forearms, as was the custom. And instead of grasping his arm, he sticks the scroll into his hand and says, read this. And he unrolls the scroll, and it's his letter from the Senate of Rome declaring him to be a Roman ambassador. And he says, do you understand what you've read? The king says, yes. And he says, what are you doing in Egypt? And the king says, what are you doing in Egypt? Right? It's not a place for you. And he says, I'm here because the Roman people have sent me here. Why are you here? And he doesn't have a good reason. And then he tells them, in the name of the way Romans term things, in the name of the Senate and people of Rome, we demand that you leave. And at least according to some reports, the king laughed at him and said, where's your army? Kind of like today's kids, right? You and what army? Right? I got a big army right here behind me. Where's your army? He said, don't you understand? I am Rome. You see the cockiness of Romans, right? He's proconsul. He said, I am Rome. The entirety of Rome is standing here, and we insist that you leave. And the king said, well, I'll think about it. I'll go back and talk to my advisors here. And we'll give you an answer. And depending on which one you believe, one says he drew a sword, the other says he took his staff. In either case, he drew a marking on the ground and he walked around the king drawing a marking on the ground. And he says, the Senate and people of Rome demand an answer before you cross the line in the sand. And yes, that's where we all get the term. We still use it 2,000 years later. The line in the sand. The Senate demands an answer before you cross the line in the sand. And Antiochus stood there for a while. And then he turned back towards his army and said, I guess we're going home. And walked away. And took his army and turned around. Well, you can imagine if you just got an entire army scared off by one man. Yeah, not in the greatest mood, right? And while he was in Egypt, yet again, good old Jason got back on the as high priest. He kicked Menelaus out yet again. Antiochus is coming back, and this is the second time in 2 years, third time in three, that Menelaus has come and said, he's kicked me off the throne again. And Antiochus decided that the problem was Judaism. And it'd be good to try to get some plunder while we're there too. Here's how 2 Maccabees, remember we talked about that the other week. Here's how 2 Maccabees describes it. When these happenings were reported to the king, that is the parties actually that were being thrown because everybody thought he was dead. He thought that Judea was in revolt, raging like a wild animal. He set out from Egypt, took Jerusalem by storm. He ordered his soldiers to cut down without mercy those whom they met, and to slay those who took refuge in their houses. There was a massacre of young and old, a killing of women and children, a slaughter of virgins and infants. In the space of 3 days, 80,000 were lost, 40,000 meeting a violent death, and the same number being sold into slavery. You know, some people think that the writer was probably exaggerating. Yeah, maybe he was. But, you know, when you compare 1st and 2nd Maccabees, you can sort of realize, you know, it was pretty gruesome. He allowed his soldiers basically to take all the frustration of not being able to plunder Egypt out on Jerusalem. And then he decided to outlaw Judaism. Instead of putting Menelaus back on the throne, he said, let's just forget about it. No more Jews, no more Judaism, I won't have this rebellion. He set up a statue of Zeus. Remember, he thought he was Zeus, so it was a statue of himself. Figure of Zeus with his own face. You know, one of those great big statues, Greek statues, with his own face on it. In the court of Israel, right behind the altar, he commanded that pigs be slaughtered on the altar in offering to himself. As if that weren't enough, he then sent an Athenian senator to make Judea Hellenized. The Ptolemies tried to do it gradually. He wanted to do it by force. He was tired of Judaism. And this is why there's that really antagonism when we get to the New Testament between Hellenistic Jews and Hebraistic Jews. The Athenian then built a gymnasium right outside the temple. The temple overlooks the valley. He put a big gymnasium in the valley. And why was that such an affront? How did Greeks practice their gymnastics? No clothes, yeah, in the nude. So anyone who stepped out of the doors of the temple was looking right down into a bunch of men who were wearing no clothes. He built Greek public baths in Jerusalem, those various fountains that were around and still around in the New Testament times. He forbade speaking Hebrew. Speaking Hebrew became outlawed. So people started speaking going back to Aramaic. They had learned it in exile. The family still usually spoke it at home. They couldn't speak Hebrew. They spoke Aramaic instead. And therefore, in the New Testament, you find even Jesus in the Gospel of Mark often speaking in Aramaic. It was a common tongue, more so even than Hebrew was. He forbade circumcision. He forbade not working on the Sabbath. To not work on the Sabbath was punishable. Everyone was commanded to use the gymnasium and the baths. That way they could check to make sure that the men weren't circumcised. If you were circumcised, you couldn't hold a public office. You had no protections, no benefit of the law. Anyone could steal your stuff, kill you or your family, and they wouldn't do anything about it. You were basically not a citizen anymore. If a woman was found with a circumcised baby, they were thrown from the walls of the city with the baby. If you called yourself a Jew or had any Jewish books or discussed Judaism in any way, you would be punished. They formed a Jewish council of elders to enforce Hellenism and answer for problems. And this was the root of what New Testament body? The Sanhedrin grew out of this body. A body that was originally meant to enforce Hellenism, not Judaism. Kind of ironic. Eventually, the king decided the only way to get rid of these high priests in Judaism was to kill all the high priests. Somebody told him they had to be a son of Zadok. He said, find the scrolls that listed the children of Zadok, and he hired men, assassins, to hunt them down and to kill them. The last of the house of Zadok died actually years after Antiochus was already dead, but the assassins continued till they had finished their contract, found in the very southern end of Egypt where he was trying to hide. And since the priesthood, we'll just get to this last point, since the priesthood was no longer sons of Zadok, the Jews, instead of just saying, well, we don't have a high priest, they started inventing lines of descent from Aaron. I found it interesting. There's even a line of descent that Jews have on their websites showing how Menelaus, who is a Benjaminite, was really a son of Aaron. It's kind of interesting. But they started, you know, whenever they had to change the high priesthood, they would just invent a new line saying, oh, he must be a descendant of. And their reasoning was simple. You have to be a descendant of Aaron to be a high priest. Therefore, if you're high priest, you must have been a descendant of Aaron. Right? So they just had to figure out how you're descended from Aaron, because you had to be, because otherwise you wouldn't have been high priest. God wouldn't have allowed it. Right? So that was their reasoning. There's sort of circular, but that was the reasoning. You can think about it during the week. We'll pick up from there and how the Jews responded to all this.